Okay, so we have our first exam coming up a week from right now here. And I sent out an email, and I have a link on the website which you can see previous exams. And like I said, I'm trying to probably be a little less analytical this time, but that will at least give you a sense of what I have done in the past. I generally will put formulas on a sheet at the end of the exam, although we won't have a whole lot of those, but you're also free to write whatever you want on a 3x5 index card. And I would like you to bring a calculator which is able to do powers of 10 and know how to do the powers of 10 on it, just because we deal with lots of powers of 10, so if I do anything analytical, it's hard to avoid those in this class. And then in terms of material, basically we'll be covering the reading material which you read last week. Not so much this week, because that's what you'll discuss in next week's recitation. So basically my philosophy is to try not to cover anything that you haven't had a chance to talk about in recitation and play with in recitation. So we'll go through the material that's basically covered in recitation this week, except there's a piece at the end which is probably the hard piece in this week's recitation, which is playing with standing waves in a sort of an analytical sense. And I'm not actually going to do that, because the reason for doing that has more to do with where we're headed than where we've been in part two. So and then lectures, basically through the part of last lecture where we talked about black body radiation and photoelectric effect. So basically from de Broglie on through Bohr atom and on. So the stuff I'm going to talk about today, we're not going to have an exam at all. Okay? Yes?
So no Bohr atom?
No Bohr atom on the exam.
So the reading we did for last week included a lot of terms and like review questions at the end. Do you think those would be helpful for the exam?
Remind me what kind of which reading that was.
It was the online reading that read kind of like a textbook.
Yeah.
Force fields up to. Up to luminosity.
And, so that was stuff on black body and photoelectric effect. Yeah, that was meant to give you background on black body and photoelectric effect. I'd have to go look and see. I mean,
that was pretty helpful for like finding specific terms for.
Pretty helpful for what?
That was pretty helpful for like finding specific terms for what we were doing in class. So.
Yeah, I mean, it was meant to be helpful. I'd have to go and look at it to think whether there's something on there which I would consider to be unfair for the exam or something. I was trying to find something that was pitched at about the right level that would be helpful, but I don't remember. I mean, it could be that I'd look at it right now. I'll try to remember to go and look at it and see if there's anything that's inappropriate. But the conceptual stuff in black body radiation and photoelectric effect is covered, so to the extent that it helps with that, that's good. But I'm not going to ask you, for example, to calculate the frequency at a certain, the peak luminosity frequency at a certain temperature or something like that. I wouldn't do that to you. Any other questions? Okay. So, the last time we started to get into a little bit of quantum weirdness, and we approached that a little bit how it happened historically. Quantum ideas really broke out in light first, and it was a pretty dramatic thing, because classical electromagnetic theory from the 1800s that was known to work extremely well and to predict all sorts of wave phenomena for light, which were very clearly established, and waves in general were understood, implied very clearly that light is a wave. And yet, events began to happen as people looked more closely at interactions of light with matter that showed that, in fact, the only way the interactions of light with matter could be understood is by picturing light as being particulate in nature and actually coming in little packets where the energy of each packet depends on the frequency. And so these two things, at least in our minds, tend to be contradictory. And so it's an uncomfortable sort of thing, but it's one of those instances where the power of the scientific methodology really comes to the forefront in my mind, because it's a little bit like, well, like it or not, that's how it is. I mean, light actually can exhibit both of those things, even though somehow that is completely strange to us. So it is the methodology of science that basically says observation wins, even if you have a bias in a certain way. Now, people struggle with it and try to understand how these two can be the same, but I guess as a physicist in my training, I learned to think of it both ways, but probably not simultaneously. And I suppose I just swallow the fact that they're both the same beast, has two different faces. And I don't know that I've ever really come to make that really comfortable in my mental picture. It's just sort of nature doesn't have that hang up. I guess it's sort of where I came down on it. So it's a bit weird. But if it's not weird enough for you, just stay tuned, because it's going to get a lot weirder. Starting with what this guy did, actually for his PhD thesis, De Bruy is what we'll call him, but his name was a bit ridiculous. He was actually Louis-Victor Pierre Raymond, 7th Duc de Bruy. He was a French nobleman, and he actually won the Nobel Prize in 1929 for this work. And what he did was basically the idea that if light can have both particle and wave characteristics, why would massive particles not also have wave and particle characteristics? Which is actually a fairly dramatic step if you think about it, because at the time, massive things fit very well in terms of particulate characteristics, and there was no reason to believe that they weren't just perfectly happy as particles. Any sort of massive thing could be thought of as a particle. And light was known to be a little bit weird. It could propagate as a wave in a vacuum, and it's this sort of self-propagating thing between electric and magnetic waves. So I guess, and the wave and particle characteristics were both fairly dramatic, and people were forced into thinking of as wave and particles, but light was a little bit strange. So De Bruy took what was known from special relativity, Einstein came up with, basically the energy of a particle is equal to this weird quantity, and this quantity, this is momentum of the particle, which is its mass times its velocity, and this is its mass, and c is the speed of light. And I mean, to see where this comes from, you have to get into relativity and look at the Lorentz transformations for energy and momentum, and we've talked a tiny bit about it, but it's not so important as to where it came from. But if we consider a particle that has no momentum, so it's something that is at rest, then this is E is equal to the square root of m squared over c, m squared times c to the fourth, which is E equals mc squared. So that's this famous Einstein equation that you always see about that heralded the nuclear age, that basically says there's an equivalence between energy and mass. De Broglie is actually interested in the other side of this equation, which is let's set the mass equal to zero. So it's for a photon or a light particle. And so if you set the mass equal to zero, then the energy of a photon should be equal to its momentum times the speed of light. And that turns out to be something that was classically known, that if you shine light on something, it actually will exert a pressure. It carries a momentum and it carries energy. And so this relationship actually was it was accepted and understood and classically. But note that it gives this relationship between momentum of the light and the energy. Then if you go to the quantum idea of light, so not in relativity, but this idea that light comes in little packets from the black body and the photoelectric effect, it was understood that the energy of each packet goes as h nu, and since it's light, well, this is a little bit strange, but you say, well, light's a packet. Also, light's a wave, and I can interpret the velocity of it as equal to lambda times the frequency. So these two, this is a statement that light has both characteristics because you're mixing them up here. And mentally, that's a little bit weird. But he's injecting both the wave characteristics and the quantum characteristics here. And you get that the energy is equal to hc over lambda, right? Just substituting in for nu here, which is v is c, and c over lambda is equal to nu. So you put that in here. And then you can also solve for e over c. And so you get one expression up here from relativity that p is equal to e over c, and you get an expression which is sort of mixing the quantum and wave characteristics, which says that e over c is equal to h over lambda. So this was explicitly derived for a massless particle, the photon. And basically de Broglie hypothesized, well, since we're now in the language of momenta and wavelengths, massive particles certainly have momenta. They can have momentum. So his hypothesis was that even massive particles would have a wavelength that's described by this formula, which down here you have it for the photon. Yes?
But how can that be true when the only way they derive that momentum equals energy over the speed of light when mass equals zero? Like if you were to have a mass, it wouldn't be true.
Right. So that's true. So this explicitly is for a massless particle, which can have a momentum, which is a little bit weird, but they do. And so de Broglie is actually saying, well, if light being massless still can have a momentum, some particle that has mass has a momentum. So he doesn't really explicitly derive it from this formula, but he says maybe this relationship is true also for massive particles. Now, I'm not a real historian, so I don't really know what his thought process was. It probably, things are seldom so crisp, although he may have had great insight, and he may have just sort of pulled it out of the blue and just simply wondered, this is true for a massless particle. I wonder if it's true for a massive particle. Because once you get it in this form, momentum you can have for either type of particle. So in some ways it seems like it was a little bit out of the blue, and it was certainly a very strange thing to say, I think. And in time, people discovered that it's actually true, because they were able to show that particles, when you arrange a system where the particle, where this quantity is large enough, that the wavelength is actually large enough to have an effect on things that you measure, you can actually see it. So there are particular cases. So people were able to take beams of electrons and demonstrate that they have interference. And in fact, some of the best techniques we have for determining structures of certain chemicals is neutron diffraction, where neutrons are, you know, massive particles. So so this is a very strange thing. So what it says, I mean, you're a particle, right? And de Broglie just said you're a wave. Now you think of yourself as sort of a particle, but in fact de Broglie says you have wave-like characteristics. So the thing is, you may wonder why you don't worry about diffracting when you go through a doorway. And to do that, we have to actually look a little bit quantitative. So if we take the formula that de Broglie says, that the wavelength is equal to h over the momentum, why don't we ask a question about, for example, what is the wavelength of a fastball in baseball? So suppose we have a baseball, and baseballs tend to have, standard baseball has a mass of about 142 grams. And if it's thrown at 92 miles per hour, this, because I want to work in the metric system, this is 41 meters per second. So we have a speed and we have a mass. So the momentum of the baseball is going to be equal to the mass converted into kilograms, to get the units right, times the speed in meters per second. So the mass in terms of kilograms, the momentum of the baseball is the mass times the velocity. And that turns out to be 5.7 kilograms, if you convert grams to kilograms, meters per second. Okay? So that's the momentum which we need. And then the wavelength of this 92 mile per hour baseball is going to be Planck's constant over the momentum. And Planck's constant we haven't had to use yet, but the number, and it's just a number, but it turns out to be an enormously small number. It is 6.6 times 10 to the minus 34 in units of joules times seconds. So this unit may seem a little bit weird, but remember that energy is equal to Planck's constant times frequency, and frequency is 1 over the period, so it's 1 over the seconds. So energy is measured in joules if you're in MKS. So this unit is in joule seconds, or you might see it in EV seconds, and the number will be different depending on which unit it's in. But in the MKS system, it's in joule seconds. So if I then divide that by the momentum, which is 5.7 kilogram meters per second, we get that the wavelength of the baseball is 1 times 10 to the minus 34 meters. The size of an atomic nucleus is about 10 to the minus 15 meters. So this is about 10 to the minus 19 times smaller than that. So you'll never see a wave-like characteristic for a baseball. It's just not going to happen. So that's why you don't have to worry about it. And the same is true for you. I mean, if you measure your mass, it's even bigger. So there was a question here.
What does that say, 5.7?
That's a kg for kilogram. I'm not going to drag you through doing these calculations. I just wanted to go through it and show you that you get a really small number.
What is the threshold between wave and particle?
That's a good question. So here's one where, you know, you have this big massive thing and the wavelength is just not noticeable. So now I'm going to do one where the wavelength is actually noticeable. So is there a question up there? No?
Yeah,
So basically, big things have wavelengths that are so small, it's irrelevant for everyday events. But let's suppose that that we have an electron that's moving in a vacuum that is accelerated across a single battery. So all that's happening is I take a battery, I put two little metal plates, and I place an electron near the negative plate so that it's pushed away from that plate. There's a force on it. It's attracted toward the positive plate. And when it goes between those two plates, by the time it gets to that positive plate, it will have an energy of 1 electron volt. I could actually drill a little hole in that positive plate, and it'll just zip right through the positive plate. And so you can actually create a little electron beam that way. So let's suppose we did such a thing. And let's ask, what is the wavelength of that? So if we were to say a 1 electron volt electron, so the electron volt is its measure of energy. This energy, when converted into joules, which is the MKS system, is 1.6 times 10 to the minus 19 joules. And what we want is its velocity if it has that energy, and we haven't worried too much about the exact form of that, but the kinetic energy of something goes as 1/2 times its mass times its velocity squared. And I'm not going to get hung up on showing you all about that, but that is the form of the kinetic energy. So one can take the energy and calculate the velocity. And when you do that, what you find is that the velocity is equal to 596 meters per second. So even accelerated across this little battery, which isn't something so powerful, you think, an electron will be going at 596 meters per second when it gets to the other side. So it's moving pretty good clip. So the momentum is equal to its mass times its velocity, and I'm pulling the mass out of a table, so I'm not going to... the mass of an electron turns out to be 9 times 10 to the minus 31 kilograms, so it's a very small mass, times its velocity, which is 596 meters per second, gives a momentum, which is 5 times 10 to the minus 28 kilograms meters per second. So for the baseball, we had a momentum, which is 5.7. So with the electron, because it's so small, its mass is so little, its momentum is really tiny. So what's going to happen is h is a small number, 10 to the minus 34. When the momentum of the object is big, like a baseball or a car or a dog or something, this number is so small, the wavelength is really small. So you just don't ever notice it. You can't see it. But if you go to where it's really small, the momentum is small. So for things that are very, very light, like an electron or a subatomic particle, all of a sudden this number becomes small, and that number is small, and the wavelength can actually be something sort of big. And so that's what we're about to see with the 1 eV electron. The wavelength of the electron at 1 eV is equal to 6.6 times 10 to the minus 34 divided by 5 times 10 to the minus 28, which is equal to 1.3 times 10 to the minus 6 meters. So that's about 1 micrometer. Now you may think that's pretty small, but your hair is only about 100 microns. So you couldn't see this. But now it's starting to be in the realm where in the laboratory it's pretty easy to see. So you can take a beam of electrons like this and you can actually run it through something that looks very similar to the two slits we tried to do with the water waves, and but now very small, so sort of atomic in character. 1 micron, the wavelength now of that electron is sort of now big on the scale of the separation of molecules in structures. And when it goes through, it'll now diffract like the wave did on the water waves or the laser that you saw. Waves are sort of weird, okay? If I have an electron coming along with a wavelength that's like this, okay, and I have 2 holes for it to go through, where does it go through? It's no longer a particle that goes through one or the other. It goes through both, and then it diffracts, and you'll get interference patterns, just like we've seen with laser and with water. And so this is no longer so small. And it has been observed. So if Planck's constant were a lot bigger, your wavelength would be bigger, and you would have to worry about diffracting as you went through a doorway or something. It'd be a very strange world. But the truth is, because Planck's constant's so small, these quantum effects you don't notice in everyday world because your momentum is very big. But if you begin to consider small particles, which are the kinds of things that make up atoms and smaller things, these effects are huge. They become very important. And you can no longer treat the particles as point-like. Any questions? All right. Just as an aside, you know, we do. I'm going to hand something out while I'm doing it. Talk to you. I'm going to hand out little gratings, and I'll tell you what these are in a minute. But just handle it around the edges as it comes to you. You know, we use light to image things. If you would hand one to her, that'd be great. Oh, sorry. Fortunately, they are not glass. We use light to image things. And one problem with light is that its wavelength is actually big compared to the size of some of the things that you'd like to image. So if you want to image structures in a cell, for example, if you're a biologist, the wavelength of visible light is actually larger than the stuff you want to see. So now you have a real problem. I mean, imagine if the wavelength of what you're using to image something is bigger than the something that you want to image, you can't get a clear image out of it because the light gets diffracted. When it bounces off, it gets sort of spread out, and you won't have a clear image at all. An example might be, suppose I had a shoebox sort of by the wall. I could take BBs and I could toss them at the shoebox, and I could create a shadow of the shoebox from the BBs, basically, because the BBs that go to each side of the shoebox would hit the wall behind it and I could notice them. And those that hit the shoebox would never get to the wall. So if I had sort of a BB detector on the wall, I would get the shadow of the shoebox. But suppose instead of BBs, I used bowling balls. I won't get a very clear shadow of this box. So that you run into a real problem when you try to image something with something else that's actually bigger. So the wavelength of light is big compared to things in the cell. So people will actually use electrons. They'll use beams of electrons because you can get the wavelength to be smaller. So that's why when you see really cool pictures of some things that are really, really tiny, and if you look in the margin, they'll call it an electron microscope. They're actually using beams of electrons and using the wave-like characteristics of the electrons to image the thing. There you go. Thanks. Wow, I randomly picked up a pile and I had exactly the right number. Okay. So what you have is called a diffraction grating. And it's a piece of plastic that has very carefully spaced lines, or very narrowly spaced lines in a piece of plastic that you can see through. If you hold it so that it's the rectangle with the long side this way, so horizontally, and you hold it up to your eye, you'll begin to see what gratings do. So what do you see?
If you look at the light, it's a rainbow.
Yeah, so what happens with a diffraction grating is it's a lot like a prism. All right. So with a prism, and we have talked about the phenomenon of refraction. And for refraction, if you have, let's say we have a prism. If I have a beam of light that's incident on this interface between air and glass, remember that it'll get refracted, it'll get bent at that interface. So this ray will get bent a little bit this way, just like it would for a lens. And then when it hits the other interface, it's bent a little bit more. So the ray of light will get bent by a prism in much the same way it does for just a regular lens that you're used to seeing. The thing is, and we haven't talked about it, the degree to which the light gets bent depends on its wavelength. This is called dispersion. It's also a wave-like characteristic. So what happens is that red light, let's say I have a white light, which I'll do as a yellow line here, incident on the prism, red light will get bent more than the blue light. Or do I have that backwards? I guess it's irrelevant for our discussion, but one of them gets bent more than the other. So what happens is you get this spectrum of light. And so you've all played with prisms before. So with a diffraction grating, you actually get the same sort of thing. It will take light and it will bend it actually both directions, and it will bend it differently for different wavelengths. And in fact, one of the things that will happen if you have a white light is you'll get a spectrum here and here. So it'll bend them both, and you'll see the colors like here and here. And then you'll see even another spectrum out here. So it actually splits it in different ways. So I want to show that to you. What I have is, okay, so why do you care? Okay, that's a good question. The reason you care is because if you really want to study the interaction of light with matter, what you'd like to do is to be able to study what intensity of light you see as a function of different frequencies, which means you have to take the light and frequency analyze it. You have to spread it out in terms of color. And that's what a prism can do, and that's what this device can do. This device can do it better than a prism, which is so gratings turn out to be the core to all sorts of instruments in chemistry and, you know, in the crime lab and in any sort of CSI thing where they're looking at light and trying to analyze chemicals, one of the things they'll do is they'll take light coming from the chemical and spread it out and look at the colors. And so you're about to see why. All right, this is a white incandescent light. So take your grating and look at that. And tell me what you see. Actually, you want to make the long side vertical, and you want the short side horizontal. What do you see?
Two rainbows on either side.
All right, so you see two rainbows on each side. So what that means is that as the white light comes through the grating, some of it gets bent and diffracted, and the white light gets decomposed into its colors, basically. And you see the spectrum of light. And one of the things that I want you to notice is that that spectrum of light is smooth. It goes from purple through green and yellow and orange all the way to red. So it starts out so purple you can't quite see it. So that would be sort of the UV side of the spectrum. And then it goes so red you can't see it. So that would be the infrared side of the spectrum. But all the frequencies that your eye can see, you will see. And the reason you will see it is because what's happening with this incandescent lamp is you're sending a current through a thin wire that has a lot of resistance, and as the electrons go through the wire, they'll actually excite a lot of the different types of molecules that are in this wire, and light of all sorts of different frequencies will get emitted. So in fact, there's a big broad spectrum of light that's coming from this lamp. And so there's a mesh of atoms, and there's a way of exciting it such that you get all sorts of things coming out, and that's why you get the smooth spectrum. Now what I'd like to do is to take the simplest molecule, the simplest atom that exists. Hydrogen. And this tube contains hydrogen gas, and only hydrogen gas. And now I'm going to send a current through that hydrogen gas, and it's going to excite the hydrogen gas, which is what that means. It's going to knock electrons out of the hydrogen atoms, and as they cascade back into the gas, into the atom, they will emit light. And you can now look at that light. And what do you see now? Maybe let me... So what do you see? Yeah.
Nothing. Just the light.
Nothing?
I was about to say on the incandescent one, when I held it, I also didn't see anything when I held it with the small side horizontal.
Really?
Yeah.
Did you put it all the way to your eye?
Yeah. When I held it like this for the incandescent one, I saw.
Yours is. Not working. I don't know why. Give you a different one. Oh, wow, this is a good one. Actually, I'm finding this one works best if the long side is held horizontal. The one in my left hand works best if the short side is horizontal. So I guess we have a mix. Sorry about that. So try both. What you want to see is the colors spread to the sides horizontally. Say again?
Don't see all the colors.
Do you see any colors?
Yeah,
I see all the colors.
Okay, so you see very particular colors. Yes?
I don't know if this is something wrong with mine, but I'm seeing tiny dots of colors, really spread out.
Yeah? That's what you're supposed to see. Right, so what you see, I see a little, very faint purple. I see an aqua and a red. But they're discrete. So what's going on here? What does that mean for what the hydrogen's doing?
It's absorbing.
Okay, you could think about it. Maybe it's absorbing all the other colors except for what you see. Or maybe it's only emitting those that you're seeing. Yes?
When I see the three dots on the side, it's almost like if they're all very, very faint rainbow or just holding the kind of lines, the bases of it, and they're sitting where they should be getting with the entire system.
Yes, that's exactly what's happening. So the light is being split as if you had the full rainbow there. But the only colors that are available are those particular ones. So the atom, it's emission instead of absorption in this case, and we're going to look at both of those. The atom is not emitting a broad spectrum of colors. It's emitting very discrete particular colors. And all hydrogen atoms will emit only those very discrete specific colors. And that's what's known as the atomic spectrum of hydrogen. That's neon. What do you see with neon? All right, neon looks orange because the colors that it emits, although discrete, which you can see with the grating, the colors that it emits are sort of in the orange, yellow, reddish region of the spectrum. Okay? But you'll note that's very different from what you saw with hydrogen. Let's do mercury. So now you see things that are a bit bluer, greener. There's a strong purple line, a fairly strong aqua line. You get this nice bluish color overall. Again, it's different from hydrogen. It is different from neon. And just for fun, we're going to do just normal air. Air is a mix of molecules and things. So now you know, because it's such a mix and mishmash of things, you're beginning to have more of a rainbow pattern with the air, because it's got a lot of different stuff in it. All right, so basically what we just saw was the following. Ooh. If you have a white light source, it gets split by this grating, right? And you'll actually see a pretty smooth continuous rainbow. If you have what we call an atomic source, so we have one particular type of element or atom in there, and you excite it, when it glows, the light that it emits comes in very discrete particular frequencies. It's always that way, and it is that way here, it is that way in California, and it is that way if it's emitted in the sun, okay? And this particular spectrum, which is basically a measure of the light, which frequencies where you see that light, it's a fingerprint for that particular atom, okay? That atomic spectrum. So that's one thing I wanted to say. The other thing I wanted to say about this is if you think of an atom in terms of wiggling charges, say in a mishmash of positive charge, you have little electrons in there wiggling, this picture just makes no sense. You can't really easily do this. Light, this is what's known as an emission spectrum. If I were to take white light and I were to send it through an aquarium full of, say, hydrogen, the hydrogen would absorb light at exactly those colors that you saw the light emitted. So that's that you can have an emission spectrum and you can have an absorption spectrum. And it's as if the absorption spectrum is the negative of the emission spectrum. The absorption spectrum, you would see the rainbow and you would have dark lines right where you had bright lines a minute ago. So atoms will only emit or absorb light at very particular frequencies. And this was... It's different for every atom. So this is really an important thing that we have to understand if we're going to understand atomic structure and the structure of matter. So that's trying to tell us something. And I think the first real inkling of what it's trying to tell us came from Niels Bohr in about 1912-ish. De Broglie, that we talked about this wavelength thing with De Broglie, that actually happened around 1924. And this happened at around 1912. So what exactly happened? There were a couple of things that came about. So let's see. Niels Bohr had spent a few years prior to around 1912 in the laboratory of a guy named Rutherford in England. And in Rutherford's lab, his students were doing something sort of interesting. They took a sample of a radioactive material, which emitted particles which we call alpha particles. And we're going to talk a bit more about these kinds of things as we go. But an alpha particle, they didn't know exactly what it was at the time, but they did know that it had a charge of +2 and it was sort of heavy. So you can think of it as sort of a heavy, slow particle. And they had observed that it could be emitted from certain natural substances which they knew existed. And so Rutherford's students were set out to do an experiment where they used these little alpha particles as probes of matter. So to give you a feeling for what they were doing, let's imagine that you'd never seen a car before. And you wanted to understand what was inside the car to some extent, or at least how it was distributed in the car, but you couldn't open the doors or the hood or anything like that. This may sound a little bit ridiculous, but one of the ways in which you could do this is you could step back 40 yards, take a high-powered rifle, and start shooting at the car. Right? When you shoot the passenger's compartment, the bullet's just going to go straight through. When you shoot the trunk, the bullet's pretty much going to go straight through. When you shoot where the engine is, the bullets are going to start ricocheting all over the place, right? So if you shoot 1,000 bullets at a car, you could more or less begin to map out where the mass is in a car. You okay with that? So that's basically what particle physicists do. We bash things together and look at the crap that comes out and try to infer what happened. So in Rutherford's lab, they took a thin foil of gold. And they had a source of alphas. They probably collimated it. I don't actually know. I imagine they did. So they took some lead or something, or actually wouldn't take much lead to stop an alpha. And so they have this beam of alpha particles coming through the gold, okay? And they had different ideas of what atoms might look like in those days. So one of the pictures they had of the atom was that where you had sort of a positive diffuse stuff with little negative electrons embedded in here. And you can calculate, that doesn't show up very well, does it? A little bit better? Okay. So you can calculate what would happen here if you sent a heavy positive particle through here. Pretty much it would see this diffuse positive charge, and depending on the distribution of that positive charge, it might get deflected a little bit. So what you would sort of expect to see are some light deflections of these alpha particles. And the way in which you could see them in those days is they could put a screen of something which is called zinc sulfide. And when an alpha particle hits a screen of zinc sulfide, it actually causes a tiny little blip of light. So you could sit there and stare at this screen and count particles that would hit it. And so his graduate students did this. They sat in dark rooms and they looked at the screen and they counted the rate at which the alpha particles would hit. And they did this as a function of angle. So if the alpha particles were only deflected a tiny little bit, then they would expect to see most of the alphas hitting over here, and when they moved the zinc screen over here, they wouldn't expect to see very many, if any, ever, in fact. So what happened was, in fact, they did see this most of the time, but when they went over here, they saw a fairly decent count of alphas basically getting kicked back. And the way it was described by Rutherford at the time, it was as if a 15-inch naval shell was being reflected by directly backwards by a sheet of paper or something. When you calculate the probability of these alphas basically being repelled and somehow coming back, it just didn't make any sense with this model of the atom. So they could calculate what the atom had to look like, and what they did was the only way they could account for what they observed was to put all the positive charge right in the center and then put the negative charge sort of diffuse out here. And now as the alpha particle goes zipping through, out here it only gets deflected a little bit because it never comes close to the positive charge. But if you have all the positive charge in the atom concentrated right at the center, those few times that the alpha, so it's like throwing darts. You seldom get near the bullseye, but once in a while you have one that goes toward the bullseye. And when you do, now it gets a tremendous repulsive kick and it goes almost straight back. And so this is known as the planetary model of the atom. And this experiment in Rutherford's lab basically showed that atoms have all of the positive charge concentrated at the center with sort of negative charge diffused around it, rather than sort of the other way around with sort of a diffuse positive charge with some of the negative scattered in. This is known as a plum pudding model of the atom. And it was actually, I think there were more proponents of this early on because this is sort of a nice way to imagine these electrons jiggling and absorbing and emitting light. But one problem with this model is not only that it does not account for how these alphas were kicked around, but it also doesn't really give you these discrete spectra that were known at the time. Atoms emitted only particular colors. So there was nothing classically that people could imagine. There's no reason why this electron might not vibrate at all sorts of different frequencies. And for it to emit and absorb only a particular color means it has to vibrate at only a particular frequency, which mechanically, I mean, I don't know how you would do that with this model. So there wasn't a good picture of that. Okay, so Bohr had worked in Rutherford's lab. He had visited with Rutherford at his lab for a couple of years. And he was a believer in this nuclear model of the atom because he knew what they were seeing, right? And Bohr developed a theory of the atom, which we call the Bohr model. And so in Bohr's model of the atom, he said that the nucleus is positive, that it's a positive nucleus in a planetary geometry. And he says that because he knows what Rutherford's seen. Okay. Then he says that the electrons orbit the positive nucleus in circles. So it's just like planets are held to the sun by the force of gravity, and so they basically would be always going in one direction except they have this force that's on them. So what is an orbit? Have anything good to throw. All right, so if I take this and I throw it a little bit, I give it a little bit of push this way, it's got the force of gravity on it. So I push it up, it slows, the acceleration is always down, so the velocity that's headed upward reduces to zero, that's the height. And then it begins to increase going down because the force is down, the acceleration is down. You okay with that? So if I throw it a bit harder, all right, then instead of sort of going like this, it goes more like that. Okay? Now you can imagine I throw it really, really hard. So here's Earth, And here I am standing here, and I just toss this thing, and it sort of goes like this, all right? And if I throw it a lot harder, it goes like that. And it's always attracted back because of the force is toward the center. Now, let's suppose I ate my Wheaties and I really throw the thing really, really hard. Now I can throw it and it's falling toward the center of Earth. And it keeps falling toward the center of the Earth, goes in a circle, and it comes back and hits me in the head. And that is what you call an orbit. It is not that there's no force on things up there. It is not even that you're weightless. It is that you are in constant free fall because you've been launched so fast. So you basically move in a circle around the Earth, and you're constantly pulled toward the center. So what Bohr said was that's what's happening with electrons. They are moving in circles where the force that's pulling them toward the center all the time is the force of the positive nucleus attracting that negative particle. Okay, so they go around in circles. Okay, so we have positive nucleus, planetary geometry, electrons orbit in nucleus in circles, and then he says something very strange, as if that wasn't strange enough. He says that only particular or discrete orbits are allowed. This is quantization. You quantize the orbit. So if you want to think about it, if I have a rock tied to a string, I can spin it around my head. I can change the length of that string to be any length I want, and I can have any orbit that you want, okay, any radius you'd like. What Bohr said was, well, for some strange reason, and I'm not going to explain to you why, we'll talk about why, but Bohr at the time, he just pulls this out of thin air, pretty much, okay? He says, for some weird reason, in atoms, only discrete orbits are allowed. So that means, it turns out, I can have a rock on a string, but that rock, the string can only have particular lengths, okay? And that's sort of a given in this theory. And then the electron, the electric force holds the electron in a circle as it orbits. So this picture of the atom is you have this positive nucleus like so, and then you have things going in a circle. Alright, so this was what Bohr was saying, is that the electron can only exist on very particular circles. And he did have a way of choosing which circles there could be, but I'm going to motivate it in a slightly different way for you, which didn't actually come about until 1924. So I'm about to do a bit of a historical fupa, but I think mentally it makes a lot more sense. How do you choose which circles are allowed? If I have a positive charge here, and I have a negative charge moving in a circle, something we'll do in recitation this coming week, you'll find that the force, if something's on a circle, if you analyze the force that it takes toward the middle, it's equal to mv squared over r, where r is the radius of the circle, and v is the velocity of that particle. And the energy, the kinetic energy of the particle, is equal to 1/2 times its mass times v squared. So there's a relationship. If the particle is going to be on a circle, there's a relationship between the radius of the circle and its energy. So there's sort of a one-to-one, I mean, there's a very particular relationship there. So if we only allow certain circumference circles, then it means that the energy for the electrons, the radii and the energy, will also be only, will be discretized or quantized, if you want to talk about it. So what in the world can do this? Well, in 1924, remember that de Broglie said, hold on, the electron isn't a particle like a BB or a rock that's being twirled around your head with a string. It's a wave. Right? Let's think of it now as a wave for a moment and ask what happens here. Remember this weird phenomenon we had where we had a string tied between two posts, and we were vibrating the string. And what you found was that only particular wavelengths or only particular frequencies would resonate and build up. In other words, you had to have it so that the wave going would interfere constructively with the wave coming back. And that wave would make a nice resonant standing wave. Okay? Imagine now taking this and turning it into a circle onto itself. So it doesn't really make sense, but try to imagine that we had a circular string and we were able to send the wave around that string. Then what we would find is only particular wavelengths would give you nice resonant vibrations on that string. And they would look something like okay, this one, for example, when it comes back, it's going to cancel out, right? So this one's not going to be a nice resonant one. Let's see if I can draw one that might be better. If the string sort of vibrated with this wavelength instead of this wavelength, you can imagine you might get it building on itself as it comes around, so that you'll get a resonant vibration and sort of this circular standing wave. So what that means is that the circumference of an orbit that's going to be stable for the electron should be an integral multiple of its wavelength. And the electron has a wavelength. So imagine, so the picture I have is, imagine trying to create a circle out of straws of the same length. You could take one straw and bend it around, and you would get one circle. If you attach two straws together, you can bend them around, and you get a different circle. They'll have different radii. But you don't get anything in between unless you go cutting straws. But what this is basically implying is that you only get this resonant standing wave for the electron if the circumference is an integral multiple of the wavelengths. So you only have orbits that exist for one straw, two straws, three straws, etc. So that actually quantizes the orbits, which means the electrons should only exist in discrete orbits with discrete energies. And that is a quantization of the atom. And that is what Bohr said. And so then, and I'll draw this up nicer for the notes that go online. I'm not going to take the time right now. What he then said was, that means the electron can exist in this orbit with a certain energy, in this orbit with a certain energy, in that orbit with a certain energy. So let's imagine we have a hydrogen atom, which happens to have a positive nucleus and one electron in it. Okay? Let us suppose that what happens when that atom absorbs light or emits light is that the electron is moving from one orbit to another because it has different energies. So we say that the electron is totally stable in this orbit, and now it gets hit with a photon that has exactly the right energy to go from one orbit to the next. Then the electron jumps to that other level. All other light of all other frequencies will go straight through the atom because it cannot be absorbed. Okay? And so that means that the atom then will only absorb very particular frequencies. Another way to look at it, if you're looking at the case where we excite the atom, by exciting the atom, what we're doing is we're putting the electron up in high orbitals, and it can only drop down to ones that exist, so only particular energy differences, because these orbitals have fixed energies. And so the photons that get emitted have to have fixed energies. That means fixed colors. And so if these orbits are different for different atoms, which they happen to be, then you're going to have different discrete colors emitted by different atoms. And so it is Bohr who basically gave us the picture as to why we see the discrete atomic structure. So there is a little applet that may help here. Okay, so here we have a picture of the Bohr model. With the electron inner shell, inner orbit. And now I'm going to ask it to make a transition to the next level up. And when that happens, it has to absorb light because it has to have energy to go out. And I can send it out another one. But notice the colors were different. So now it's excited, and suppose I want it to go down to the inner level. It's going to emit a photon, and that photon has to have a very particular energy, which is the energy difference between this orbital and that orbital. Okay? Oh, did it happen? And so it emits light when it does that of this particular frequency. If I have it out here again, and I have it jump to this orbital, it emits light, but now the frequency was different. And it will always be at that frequency. If it jumps to this third orbital, the second orbital in, it's yet a different frequency. So by determining what the radii are, or the energies, it also determines exactly what the colors are that are emitted when the electron jumps from an outer orbital into an inner orbital, or absorbed as it goes from an inner orbital to an outer orbital. It takes energy to move the electron from this inner orbital out to an outer one, so it absorbs light to do that, but it will only do it at particular frequencies. So if we had an atom that existed and it looked just like this, and we excited and we asked what colors will it absorb, it will only absorb three colors. It'll absorb a color that corresponds to this difference in energy, a color that corresponds to that difference in energy, and a color that corresponds to that difference in energy. Actually, I lie. You'll also get this one and this one. So it's like five different colors. So at that case, you would look at this thing and you would see five discrete lines. And they would be very particular colors. And so now I hope you're beginning to see the power that we have with the spectrum, because it basically gives us a way of determining what these orbitals look like inside the different atoms. And because the different types of atoms have different structures, it's a fingerprint for that type of atom. And all hydrogen atoms have exactly the same set of orbitals. So I'm out of time. That's the Bohr model. Anyway, we'll come back to this. Oh, if you would bring the gradings up, I'd appreciate it. Thank you.